Okay, thanks Tim for that great talk. I think what those talks will do is give us a diverse overview of the climate change issue, both from impacts, adaptation, vulnerability and mitigation. I'd now like to invite the presenters up to the panel. And we have about 15 minutes for questions. I'd like to encourage people who have not asked questions to really start off by asking questions. Don't be shy.
I have a question for Tim. I'm just curious as to, so how much, say, wind power energy and what's happening in the north right now or even in other countries too? Like how significant is wind power or other sources of renewable energy just in terms of quantity of what's going on?
In Canada, we have one wind turbine in a remote community. It's in Rankin Inlet. We do have a couple that have been operating in the north in Yukon, but they're connected to the larger grid. I think the sad part about what happened is that most of the wind energy technology and innovation was done in Canada. A lot of it was done here in Quebec. Hydro-Quebec actually did a lot of the early research. And then all that funding and support dried up, and Alaska has basically taken it, re-engineered it, and it's sort of in the process of selling it back to us. So it's a bit of a sad story, actually. But we do still do have the experts, and we still do have some of the development technology in Canada. And there's no reason we couldn't be moving faster than we are. But right now we're really behind the game, I guess, in terms of what's going on in Australia and Alaska even.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the talk. I was just curious. Indigenous communities often have sort of a more symbolic or cultural connection to the land, and I was wondering if one of the barriers or challenges, or perhaps you're seeing any resistance to how, for example, a wind turbine would restructure that relationship.
It's a good question. I mean, from my perspective, in the communities I work in, there's been no real renewable energy developments or wind power. So.
It's interesting you ask that question because this particular community, when they put up those wind turbines, some of the elders went out and were looking for the birds at the bottom, and they were angry that they were still going to have to go hunting. They said, we thought we were going to be able to come here and collect them. So, and I'm not making that up either. That's a true story. That's not to say there aren't real impacts from this type of development as well, and you do want to be careful about where you put the turbines. The birds can hit them, there's no doubt about that. And so you need to be careful in where they go. But generally that's not a real barrier. The barriers tend to be more logistic in terms of how far away you get from the airport. And in terms of other environmental impacts, it tends to be melting permafrost that is probably the biggest challenge in putting the foundations in.
Hi there, Donald Cole, University of Toronto. A question for Alexandra. You have presented some findings that are kind of damning of a number of countries. And so I think it's going to be important to, and I need some help, in understanding how you've made your judgments, right? How do you say that there's no reference to, and that sort of thing? So that's one piece out of the documents you actually did work with. And the second is, are there going to be, one of the things we learn is that there are all kinds of local initiatives, local things happen. They happen at multiple scales. My wife works on municipal adaptation planning in Ontario and that sort of thing. And so I guess it's sort of like, how do you actually check of the quality of the reports that are going into, the Annex 1 that countries are submitting? How much resources do those places or do the teams that are submitting the report actually have to actually find out what's happening in their own country? And then how do you do that kind of validity work is what we kind of think about it. and coverage and that sort of thing?
That is an excellent question. And that was one of the biggest limitations, actually, of using the national communications as our data source, is that they're national-level documents. So 78% of the actions that we recorded are at least happening in conjunction with national governments or exclusively through national governments, which is why we say that this is not an inventory of adaptation that's happening in developed countries. There's a lot that's happening at regional levels or at local levels that's not being captured in these documents. Furthermore, this is just one chapter of a broader document. The guidelines provided by the UNFCCC touch on different themes that countries need to report on, but are not quite as tight as the reporting guidelines they have for mitigation, for instance. So that was something that we were very conscious of during this process. But what we really were able to get out of this was an idea of what the priorities of these national governments are. So when they're talking explicitly about extreme heat and health, or they're only talking about flooding in regards to built environments and not health, and that's kind of an indication of where these policymakers' minds are at. And that was sort of the end goal that we had. It wasn't to come up with a complete list of what's going on in Europe or North America, but to just sort of get a snapshot, a flavor of what the current status of adaptation is. In order to go below that level, the main difficulty would be finding a systematized source of information that would allow you to compare across all of these countries. The great thing about the national communications is everybody's following the same guidelines, so you can do a systematic assessment based on those documents. In order to get an unbiased information source, however, I think that'd be really difficult if you're going below the national level.
So how about examining sources of heterogeneity? In other words, where are the differences? Like, are federal kinds of countries, do you see poorer reporting or poorer indications of movement than unitary countries? I'm not suggesting that was necessarily true. When I saw Portugal, which went through a horrendous heat wave and still no policy, that was quite striking. But is there any difference by the nature of the country, the structure of their policy? I mean, if we're thinking about informing policies, the nature of policy communication among different organizations, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, there was definitely a significant difference between different countries and the level of reporting they were doing. So countries like the UK or Australia, Canada, the US, English language countries had much more extensive documents. There were also some, however, like Belarus or the Ukraine, which also provided very extensive reports. So that was kind of came as a little bit of a surprise to us. So you do get some variation there. What we decided to do was just focus on what was happening at the national level. We also had actions that were reported happening at lower levels. We decided to disregard those to try and kind of get a more even spread of what's going on. In response to what you said actually about Portugal, they did have a really severe heat wave in 2003. And Lisbon does have a heat response plan that I just happen to know about on the side. The difference is that Portugal isn't reporting on that heat response system in the context of climate change. So they may have heat is an issue here, but they are not demonstrating an understanding of how climate change is going to exacerbate that threat in the future and the implications that that's going to have for community health.
Wow. So. I mean, it'll be fascinating when we hear about how, when you take that out and interact with the policymakers, and start sharing that, how they react. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, Alice's project is part of a bigger project that we're doing. We're basically trying to track adaptation. We're asking the question, is adaptation taking place? The first stage of this project was to look at a global scale. We asked the question, are we adapting to climate change globally? Yeah. And it's a difficult question because, like mitigation, we can measure greenhouse gas emissions relatively easy at a global level. We can measure atmospheric concentrations of CO2, methane, and so forth. We can even estimate how much different nations are emitting. Adaptation's a bit more difficult to do. It's messier. What is an adaptation? How do you measure adaptation? So the first iteration of this, we just used the peer-reviewed scholarship. We looked at what had been published and how many articles were there on adaptation. What were the adaptations taking place? Which nations were adapting? We argued it was a proxy of what was going on. And then the work Alex is doing is kind of the next stage of that. We're trying to find new ways of developing indicators of adaptation, indicators which we can track over time. And the Framework Convention on Climate Change, national communications are one source of information. The same project, we're also working within Canada. We have projects looking at what the civil society organizations are doing across Canada. of adaptation, and also focusing in on Ontario. I think Jacqueline, who's in the audience somewhere, has got a project looking at what are public health authorities in Ontario doing about health adaptation. So really a diverse number of methods basically trying to answer this question: is adaptation taking place? How is it taking place? Where is it taking place? What factors are causing it to take place?
Yeah. Great work.
Such important research, very exciting to listen to. I want to go to the next question. For me, we have all these ideas about great policy. Is anyone studying, or what do they know about the best ways to change policy? If we want to affect policy, what do we know about what works and what doesn't work? Is that being looked at cross-culturally? It's time now to do these things. So what do people know about how policy changes? How do we do that?
Interesting question, good question. Certainly the Climate Change Scholarship from the adaptation where I work, pretty much, you know, the last decade has been very much focused on knowledge generation, basically. How are communities being affected by climate change? How are different economic sectors being affected by climate change? What makes them vulnerable? What is it about climate change that makes them vulnerable? The physical stresses? What is it about the social and the economic and the cultural factors that make them vulnerable? Using that to identify entry points for adaptation. So in my own work, the last decade has been very much just trying to document that baseline understanding of the drivers. Now we're starting to take them at the next step and seeing what can be done. In one project we're doing in Northwest Territories, one of the key things that's come up again and again in the North is the importance of traditional knowledge. Traditional knowledge for using the sea ice safely, very, very important in the context of changing climate. Traditional knowledge and culture also underpins health. There's been numerous research which has demonstrated where people have links to their culture in the North, they have low levels of suicide. So traditional knowledge preservation and promotion has been identified as a key aspect for climate change adaptation. But how do you do that? There's multiple different methods out there to do it. So one of the projects that we're trying to find out is exactly how. We're going to do some targeted projects in communities where we actually fund an intervention. One project we're developing participatory traditional knowledge databanks, basically where interviews with elders are put on the web, including videos, including audio recordings, kind of information that traditionally would have been in a report in a library and never read. We're trying to put that online and make it accessible to people through various ways. Actually, Will over here is leading that project. And we're going to try and find out, you know, how can we reach the younger generations? Because those are the generations in the North, and in many indigenous communities, who we have the biggest concern about. They're the ones who are going to be here when the climate changes the most. They're the ones who are going to need the most advice on how to adapt. And there's a lot that traditional knowledge has for that adaptation. So we're trying to find ways to reach that younger generation through traditional knowledge databanks online, through social media, things like Facebook, through radio dramas on the radio, through theater, and so forth. So I really see that as being the kind of where things are going, where things definitely need to go over the next decade.
I wish I had an answer as to how we change policy. I think obviously developing or looking for what policies have been successful and developing frameworks is an important step. I mean, in terms of the work we do, we're obviously out being advocates and lobbyists effectively and trying to push those policies. I think where we've been successful has been, in the North, where there has been successes, there has been community push and a ground level push as well. And so I think it's having those two things at the same time, where you've got the policy that you can pitch to the politicians, but then you also have the bottom up ask and demand for it. And I think that's what happened in Ontario when Ontario passed the Green Energy Act. It was largely because you had the environmental groups and the NGO sort of pushing clean energy, but then you also had unions and farmers groups coming together and saying, yeah, this is something we want. And so I think when you had, particularly the farmers and the unions coming together, it was a whole different push from when, you know, Greenpeace and Pembina Institute were asking for something. So.
Okay, last question.
Alexandra, the popular press implies that the United States does not have a climate change policy, but your presentation would suggest that there's a national, at least recognition in many cases, that climate change is a threat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially since 2008, a lot of the research being done on climate change at the national government has really exploded. And so there's a lot of really great vulnerability and adaptation research going on right now within the national government. There are also particular projects going on in more like local areas, especially with infrastructure development and things like that. So definitely there's a common perception that the U.S. is kind of one of the world's great failures when it comes to climate change, but I think that we're seeing that turn around in the last couple of years, which is kind of coming through in all the national reporting that they're doing.
The same in Canada. We're pretty terrible at greenhouse gas emissions, but we're actually not too bad when it comes to adaptation. Okay, last question.
Oh, thanks so much. Just sneaking in under the bell. I just wanted to follow up to Don's comment, because I thought that was really fascinating and it sort of surfaces a number of different issues, and he was asking just about methodology. And I think what you're doing is probably pretty accurate in terms of a surrogate marker, because I was thinking when countries report to treaty bodies or around specific conventions, the default that they tend to do is they roll up absolutely everything that they're doing programmatically. Mm-hmm. So even a federated country like Canada would do that. And the critique, of course, of that is you're just measuring what you're doing and not outcomes towards what that actual convention is moving towards. So I think you're probably not too far off in terms of that. But at our table, we were just curious about what your analysis was around the Ukraine and why they were at the, if you like, the top of the pack. And all we could think of was it sort of the experience around Chernobyl and enhanced sensitivity, or?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say that they're at the top of the pack. They just had fairly extensive chapter detailing vulnerability and adaptation. When you actually take it apart and look at what a lot of it means in terms of climate change, frequently what you see is countries are throwing in things that are, you know, relevant to water, relevant to food, but don't necessarily have a strong climate change component. And so it's a lot of that stuff that we're excluding. So, I didn't mean to suggest that the Ukraine is coming up as a leader in climate change adaptation, mostly just that they're putting a lot of text in there. So.
Okay, I'd like to thank the today's presenters. Thanks.
Now, as you might have seen your agenda, it's time for dessert. And another break that will give you a chance to go and visit the poster presentations on global innovations and case studies around the world from our policy fellows. And then we'll all join back here for our Green Jobs and Social Entrepreneurship panel. Thanks so much.